He also served as FDA's chief scientist, where he was responsible for leading and coordinating FDA's cross-cutting scientific and public health efforts. He was FDA's acting commissioner between April 2015 through February of this year. In his career before FDA, he served as the deputy director of the National Center for Infectious Diseases at CDC, and he retired from the Commission Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service at rank of Rear Admiral. He is a fellow of the Infectious Disease Society of America and the American College of Physicians, and prior to assuming the role of FDA's acting commissioner, he chaired the Public Health Committee of the American Society for Microbiology's Public and Scientific Affairs Board. Many of us fondly remember Dr. Ostrov as the director of the Bureau of Epidemiology in Pennsylvania and a former president of CSTE. I personally remember Steve best from when I was first elected to the CSTE Executive Board as the Surveillance and Informatics Steering Committee Chair. And Steve really went out of his way to help me in my new role. Let none of us underestimate the power that we all have as mentors. Steve was winner of the coveted CSTE Pump Handle Award in 2013. And it is with great honor that I welcome Dr. Steve Ostrov to the podium.
Thank you so much, Janet. It's really great to be here, not only because it's an opportunity to come to another CSTE meeting, which I loved doing, and I sort of had been thinking back to the first one that I came to, and it was either in Minneapolis back in the 1980s, or it could have been the one in Saratoga that was hosted by the New York Department of Health. I think they were right around the same time, and so it's really great to be here, and it's especially great to be here in Alaska. And before I start out on my presentation, I did need to give a shout out to the folks in the room who are from Pennsylvania. It's great to see so many of you. So as Janet mentioned, I'm now at FDA. I have been at FDA for almost 3 years. It'll be 3 years in a couple of months, and I'm now in my fourth position at FDA, which goes to show you that they keep on moving me around until they find something that's appropriate for my skill sets. But I took over just a couple of weeks ago as the Deputy Commissioner for Foods and Veterinary Medicine, which is a topic I'm relatively comfortable with, given that all those years ago at CDC, when I started working there, I was working in foodborne disease and in enteric diseases in the enteric disease branch back then. So I thought it was a nice bookend for my career. And I thought what I would talk about today is the title that I put on this slide, which is Food and Veterinary Medicine Update, or in subtitles, there are some things that you can do as a regulator that you can't as easily do as an epidemiologist. So moving to FDA was definitely a very significant change in career, and it makes me think of some of these quotes, which is that there are no second act in American lives, or as Yogi said it, when you come to a fork in the road, take it, because it's really a very different place, but it's a place where you can also achieve a lot in the public health arena. And in partnership with CDC, I think it's a very good partnership in terms of being able to get things done. And for those of you who have never been to FDA, this is our main campus in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's a relatively new campus, sort of like CDC's main campus. It's a very nice place to work, and there are about 10,000 people that work on this particular campus, and I have to admit to being very surprised when my predecessor, Peggy Hamburg, made the decision that she was going to leave FDA, and somehow after a series of meetings where I kept on thinking somebody was going to come to their senses, I ended up actually being the acting commissioner for FDA, a position that I held far longer than anticipated for almost a year. And although I'm going to be talking about the food and veterinary side of FDA, I can tell you that the position of acting commissioner, even on an acting basis of FDA, is a really, really tough one because we deal with so many incredibly high-profile topics and areas that make the news. And this is just a very short list of some of the non-food-related issues that I dealt with as acting commissioner just over the last year. And certainly many of you remember the PharmaBro and the issue around drug prices. And we got involved in this because of our regulation of getting generics onto the market and the impact that that could have in potentially lowering some drug prices. This was incredibly controversial, falling in the middle of the opioid misuse epidemic, since we're the ones that approve the opioids that come to market. And probably one of the more controversial things that I did over that year was to approve the labeling indication to be able to use OxyContin in pediatric patients. And certainly, I can tell you that didn't go over very well, but we thought from a scientific perspective it was the right thing to do. There's always lots of issues around medical marijuana and how medical marijuana would be regulated by an agency like FDA. One of the big things that we recently accomplished was what we refer to as the deeming rule, which was finalized about 2 months ago and brings e-cigarettes under the regulatory oversight of FDA. On the medical product side, there was the issues related to duodenoscopes and all of the problems associated with that. We started dipping our toe in the water at looking at how FDA regulates homeopathy, something we hadn't looked at in many years and is quite controversial. There's the President's Precision Medicine Initiative. There's all of the issues around doing genome testing, the Vice President's Cancer Moonshot, how we regulate the burgeoning wireless technology industry and which apps should be regulated as medical devices and which ones shouldn't. There was all of the Ebola and the Zika issues. One that we finalized last December while I was acting commissioner, which is the new donor policy for men who have sex with men, which of course became a huge issue last week after the unfortunate incident in Orlando, and all of the gay community wanted to be able to donate blood and were deferred from doing that. And probably one of the more controversial is this issue of gene editing, particularly gene editing of embryos with hereditable traits. And it gives you a sense of how difficult many of the things that you have to deal with in a day in and day out basis at FDA would be. But I'm going to turn to the food side. This is one way to look at some of the work that we do related to food. But I'll put up, and this is what I'm going to be discussing. I'll be discussing some of our food safety initiatives, talk about some of the nutrition initiatives, because even though I'm a food safety infectious disease guy, I've really come to realize what incredible impact you can have at public health in an agency like FDA on with some of the nutrition initiatives we've been involved in. Talk a little bit, I can't come to Alaska in particular without talking about genetic engineering and as it relates to foods, talk a little bit about antimicrobial resistance, and then at the end we'll do some questions. So I think no less than Woody Allen probably has the ultimate solution to foodborne disease. So he solved it by saying, I never eat oysters. I want my food dead, not sick, not wounded, but dead. So if you think about it, if everybody did that, we'd probably have a lot less foodborne disease, but they don't do that. So this is the FoodNet data. And this is the FoodNet data dating back to 2004. And over the course of this meeting, people put up lots and lots of interesting graphs. And this is about one of the least interesting graphs I think that I've ever seen, because if there's a trend there, I don't see it. It's about as flat line as it can possibly be when it comes to the incidence of foodborne disease as it's been monitored by the FoodNet sites. And this is another way to look at it. This is CDC's FoodNet data report that came out in April, and you know, they do this with the nice smiley faces for each of the organisms. There's the healthy 2020 targets, and what you see there is, you know, one smiley face, two unhappy faces, and three faces that, you know, don't have much to say, whether be they're happy or unhappy, because, you know, I think this is the epitome of not making a heck of a lot of progress in terms of reducing the incidence of foodborne disease. And this is another graph from that report, and this looks at the relative rate of occurrence of foodborne disease in comparison to the baseline when FoodNet started in 1996. And, you know, if you really look at it, except for the one that's going way up, which is the Vibrios, all the rest of them, you can say, well, we've done something, because the relative rates for all of them are slightly or somewhat below one in comparison to the way that they were in 1996. But another way to look at it is if you take off the first 2 years, it really looks a little bit different in that there really haven't been any sizable changes in the relative rate for any of these organisms over an awful long period of time. And it makes you have to say, well, it's really time to do something different if we really think that we're going to be able to make progress in reducing the overall burden of foodborne disease in the United States. And on top of that, you know, this, I know there are sessions over CSTE talking about a lot of these, but we have sort of the greatest hits collection of 2015, and the two there on the left are Listeria, the one in the middle with the cucumbers, which we heard about yesterday, is Salmonella, the cilantro is Cyclospora, the Chipotle was a 90157-STEC, and we never quite figured out what the cause of that one was, but I would assume that in all of these instances, these are FDA-regulated products. So the vehicle that we're trying to ride to really make some change in the trends that you saw in those previous slides is something that's called the Food Safety Modernization Act, and I would hope that there are folks in the audience who have heard of FSMA. That's how we refer to it. FSMA is a law that was signed by the president in 2011. It was signed in response to a lot of the widespread foodborne outbreaks that occurred in the late 2000s, such as the peanuts and the tomatoes / jalapeno peppers, and some of the really big ones that made people think that it's time to take a look at this one differently. FSMA is designed to take a farm-to-fork approach, and it uses several central tenets to try to change the paradigm in the food system. And one of them is that it's meant to move the food system to one in which we largely react to problems once we recognize them, to actually trying to prevent them from occurring in the first place. It also places the major burden and the major responsibility on industry to take the steps that are necessary to produce safe food. It also has as another tenet that food that is produced inside the United States should be every bit as safe and should be held to the same standards as food that's produced outside of the United States. And it also has FDA in the role of actually trying to promote with those that we regulate, to educate them, to train them on how to do it right, rather than simply coming along and telling them you're doing this, this, and this wrong. It's a really big sea change paradigm for the way that we do inspections. And another is the very critical role of a whole variety of partners to make this successful. So FSMA is, the law itself gets translated into implementation through what we refer to as 7 foundational implementing rules. We spent 5 years trying to write all of the necessary rules to put FSMA in place, and all of them are now finalized, and they went final, the last of them went final on just a few weeks ago on May the 26th, just before Memorial Day. And the 7 rules, one of them is preventive controls for human food. So any industry that produces food for human consumption has to put in place preventive measures, looking at critical control points, and put in place preventive measures to reduce those risks and then to demonstrate through one way or another that those controls are actually working. The second of them is preventive controls for animal foods. The third one, and the one that I have highlighted here and put in red because of our recent experience with outbreaks, is for the very first time FDA will actually reach to the farm level and put in place requirements for produce safety. This is a big deal for us to now start doing that for the very first time. Another is foreign suppliers, and so we will put the onus on those who import food into the United States to guarantee that that food was produced with equivalent levels of safety to food produced in the United States. Third-party certification allows us to be able to certify, especially overseas, individuals to accredit those that do the inspections and those that do the audits. There is a rule to assure sanitary transportation of food once it leaves either the farm or once it leaves the factory to assure that they could do good work at that point, and then it could all become contaminated during transport. And many of us have had experience with that. And the last one that went final is to be able to put in place food defense procedures to reduce the likelihood of intentional adulteration. All of these rules, now that they're finalized, have staggered dates of implementation as to when industry actually has to start complying with them, and the first of the compliance dates is September of this year for preventive controls for the largest producers. So I just thought I'd spend a minute talking about what's in the produce safety rule, because as I said, this is a new thing for FDA to be doing. And what it did was it took a risk-based approach to look at the potential routes of contamination and how it could occur with on a farm. And so these are the six things that farms now have to do to comply with the produce safety rule. One of them has to do with the quality of the water that they are using for irrigation purposes, especially irrigation purposes where the water will touch the fruit. The second is they have to deal with what we refer to as biological soil amendments of animal origin, a nice way to say compost or manure. And there are certain ways that that has to be treated, and there are certain times that it can be used and certain times that it can't be used. The third is we're all familiar, especially when you deal with places like Mexico, about the importance of worker hygiene, and there are requirements for worker hygiene. There are sections of the produce safety rule that deal with animal encroachment to make sure that animals can't get into areas where foods are actually being grown, whether or not they're domestic animals or they're wild animals. The way the farm buildings are constructed to assure that little rodents can't get inside. And then how farm equipment itself is maintained and how it is cleaned. And we think that routine applying these types of things has really the potential to change the patterns and the occurrence of outbreaks that may be related to produce. So we're pretty excited about this one. In order for this to work, it's going to be really critical to have both foreign and domestic partnerships. For example, we've established with Mexico, which is our largest trading partner for produce, something called the Produce Safety Partnership, where we will work with them to oversee the farms that are exporting to the United States. Domestically, we've developed cooperative agreements with the National Association of States Department of Agriculture, with the USDA, with a series of universities around the country to help do the training of the farmers that are going to have to comply with this. And we've also developed a cooperative agreement with states. The applications were due just the week before last for the states to be able to engage in training and education and even inspections of the farms that are required to be regulated, and in 2016 we'll be putting $19 million out to the states. In most instances it's State Department of Agriculture, but in some of the instances it's the State Departments of Health that were the applicants, and this funding will grow over time as more of the provisions of the produce safety rule come into force. And so I really do think that this is an exciting opportunity. I also did just briefly want to mention whole genome sequencing, which I think is also a game changer in terms of how we approach foodborne disease. In 2012, FDA established something called the Genome Tracker Network, and this was meant to be a distributed network of state and federal labs that were looking at specimens that were either environmentally collected or from foods or in some cases humans, in order to be able to improve source attribution and outbreak detection. It includes the pathogens you see there. and the sequences themselves are being stored by NIH's National Center for Bioinformatics because they have an amazing capacity. And in partnership with CDC in 2013, we launched the project to look at all Listeria monocytogenes isolates that are collected either from food, animal, or human sources. The network today includes FDA, CDC, USDA's FSIS, 14 states, and 9 international labs, and this is a map of where the genome tracker laboratories are based to give you a sense of where they're distributed. I think that this should dovetail very well with what CDC is doing to build whole genome sequencing capacity in the states. And this looks at the total number of isolates that have been put into the genome tracker database up to, I think, a month or two ago. And as you can see for Salmonella, there's already 50,000 Salmonellas that have had whole genome sequencing performed within this network. And so it's quite robust and it's growing, I think, quite nicely. Let me turn to diet and nutrition. And these are two quotes that I like. Some of you who are older in the room may remember these folks. Buddy Hackett once said, as a child, my family's menu consisted of two items, take it or leave it. And Toady Field said, I've been on a diet for 2 weeks and all I've lost is 2 weeks. And so these are sort of the two things that on the nutrition side we've been trying to address. One of them is what Americans are eating, and the second is how much of it they're eating. And so we've had things in place where we've been trying to deal with both of them. Probably the first one, which occurred in 2015, is that we made a determination that partially hydrogenated oils or trans fats were no longer considered to be the term du jour at FDA is GRAS, which means generally recognized as safe. And the rationale behind that is the cardiovascular consequences of trans fats. And we made a determination that there is no safe limit for adding trans fats to the diet. Industry had 3 years from the time that we made that determination to comply with that requirement, in other words, to remove added trans fats from the food supply. It allowed them sufficient time to reformulate foods to be able to do that, although they were permitted to submit petitions to us to ask for a variance from this requirement and potentially be able to convince us that small amounts of trans fats may still be okay from a public health perspective. And they actually have submitted them for several food types, which they'd have lots of difficulty actually making if there weren't some trans fats in them. We have not ruled on any of those petitions, and we probably won't until 2018. The second is under the Affordable Care Act, there were provisions to require menu and vending labeling. This is put on menus the calorie counts. The way that the law was written, it covered establishments that have at least 20 outlets and includes restaurants, grocery stores, home delivery, movie theaters, et cetera. It's actually quite wide-ranging, and it requires listing of calorie counts for all menu items that are displayed and other nutrition information, such as sodium, et cetera, on demand. The initial implementation date for these provisions was supposed to be 2015, but for a whole variety of reasons, including lots of pushback from industry, which I learn occurs a lot, the implementation date has been delayed. We issued guidance just last month about how industry has to do this, and according to provisions that were put in our appropriations last year, this can't come into effect until at least 12 months after that guidance was issued, and so the earliest compliance date will be May of 2017, and it's worth noting that this pertains on menus and it also pertains on vending machines, which is another very interesting aspect of it, which hasn't gotten as much attention. Some of you may be aware a couple of weeks ago we issued the final version of the revised nutrition facts label. This is the first revision of the nutrition facts label since 1994. So it was finalized in May and was announced by the First Lady, who's had very big nutrition initiatives while she's been in that role. The The actual revision changes take effect starting in 2018. However, if a company makes a decision to reformulate their product 6 months after this rule is finalized, then they have to put the revised formulation in the new format of the nutrition facts label. Accompanying that was revisions to serving sizes. I was looking at a little thing I got out of a vending machine yesterday, which was a little bag of chips or something like that, and it said that it was 2.5 serving sizes. But we recognize most people don't eat a bag of chips 2.5 times. They eat it all at once, and so there's a much more realistic depiction of serving sizes. Larger calorie displays to make it easier to find it, and probably the provision that by far was the most controversial that we had to repropose was to add the category of added sugars. And so on the new nutrition facts label, there will be total sugars, and then there'll be a separate category for added sugars, which are the sugars that are more controllable by the manufacturer. We consider added sugars to be empty calories. They will have to list those added sugars as total grams, and they will have to list them as a percent daily value. And the Dietary Guidelines for America said that only 10% of your total daily calories should be in the form of added sugars. If you have a 2,000-calorie diet, that means only 200 of those calories should be in the form of added sugars. And if you take your average can of Coca-Cola and they have to declare what percent of the daily value that they happen to be, you can do the math and they will be more than 100% of the recommended daily value. And part of the reason that this is taking effect 2 years from now is that we're giving industry time to make changes to the formulations of their products so that they don't look quite that outlandish on the new version of the nutrition facts label. So we think that this not only is a good thing to be able to give consumers additional information for their food choices, but that industry will do a lot in the next couple of years to change the amounts of some of these unfortunate components of your food supply. So the last one just to talk about, which came out just 2 weeks ago, is voluntary sodium reduction targets. I know when I was on the CSTE board, this was an issue that we very strongly supported, so it's fine to now see it finally get across the finish line. So the average American consumes about 3,400 milligrams of sodium per day, and 75% of all of the sodium that you consume is either in processed foods or in food served to you in a restaurant. So it's not food that you can actually do very much about not to consume that much sodium. We know that there would be major cardiovascular health gains from reductions, even though this has been scientifically controversial. And we issued on June 1st draft reduction guidance to reduce the amount of sodium in the food supply, a 2-year target to get the amount of sodium in the food supply down to 3,000 milligrams, and within 10 years to get it down to 2,300 milligrams. And the way that we did this was that we split the food supply into 16 different food categories, and within those categories divided it further into 150 different commodities. We took everything that was currently on the market and we looked to see each of the products within those categories, what the amount of sodium that they had listed on their labels happened to be, and we came up with a sales-weighted mean for that commodity category, and then we established a reduction target for each of those categories. And we know that in some categories like cheeses or some categories like deli meats where salt is not just in there for its taste, but it has other purposes for being there, reducing the sodium levels will be somewhat challenging. But the advantage to this particular approach is it covers, every American has a different type of diet. And so it covers the whole range of what it is that the average American, or no average American, but any American would actually eat. And so there's some benefit in here for everybody. And no less than the New York Times, the editorial there the other week said that this was a smart way to help people eat less salt. And we're really looking forward to this being a major benefit. I'm just going to touch upon a couple of other things quickly. One of them is we recently also put out a risk assessment and an action level for the amount of inorganic arsenic in rice. And this is arsenic is obviously known to have both acute and chronic toxicity. Chronic exposure can deal with carcinogenicity or fetal and infant neurodevelopmental consequences, as well as other types of chronic diseases like diabetes. And rice is known to disproportionately absorb inorganic arsenic. And many of you may remember a couple of years ago, FDA went through this big issue with arsenic in apple juice that infants were consuming. And so we felt it was important to do something about this potential risk. This is a graph looking at inorganic arsenic levels in rice versus non-rice products. The rice products are down on the bottom. Apple juice is also on there. And the amount of exposure that you have from rice products is dramatically higher than it is in any of the other products that an infant may consume. And so just in April, we put out a risk assessment and we put out an action level limiting infant rice products to have no more than 100 parts per billion of inorganic arsenic. We also put out risk communication about especially populations that consume large amounts of rice, such as Asian populations and Hispanic populations, that especially when they begin feeding with their infant, that they should use a variety of grains rather than trying to do it by weaning them off with rice products. Some of the additional things that have gone on recently at FDA, one of them is allowing folic acid fortification in corn masa, something that had been asked for quite a bit. We're in the process of working on seafood advice for pregnant women and young children to encourage pregnant women to consume more seafood for the health benefits for their infants than they currently do. We determined that the term that's used on a lot of food products, which is evaporated cane juice, which is the current term that's used instead of sugar, shouldn't be used because we would prefer that people use it, sugar, because that's what it is. And then we're in the process of seeking comments to try to clarify terms like natural and healthy. No easy task. So let me just touch upon one. I'm here in Alaska. Probably one of the big controversies that I was involved in when I was the acting commissioner, was the approval of the genetically engineered salmon. And I can tell you this played less well in Alaska than it did in most parts of the country. And so here's one of the editorial cartoons, and here's another one. So how do I know if it's natural or genetically modified frankenfish, which was the term that was used for this? And it shows the two parts of the problem that we had. One of them was actually approving a genetically modified food animal, which was the first time that we had done this. And the second is whether or not the product itself should be labeled as being genetically engineered. Both incredibly controversial issues. And so in November of 2015, we approved the genetically engineered salmon after close to 20 years of review within FDA, first approval of a GE-modified animal for food. The difference between this fish and other farm-raised Atlantic salmon is it matures in half the time that it otherwise would. We have looked at this fish in every way that we can, and there is no identifiable difference in the structure or nutritional content of the fish compared to non-GE modified fish. One of the reasons that it's regulated the way that it's regulated at FDA is the insertion of the genetic material that makes the fish grow better is very specifically designed to affect the structure or function of the fish. And that's the definition of a drug that FDA uses. And so it's regulated as a new animal drug within the agency. So there were huge controversies over the approval and labeling requirements for this fish. We use the concept of materiality in making a determination about whether something is required to be labeled, which is there a change in the nutritional content or is there a change in the allergenicity that would affect your health? In such circumstances, we require that change be labeled. But if it isn't, we don't have a basis to require something to be labeled. And so we issued voluntary labeling guidance at the time the fish was approved to do two things. One of them is to say how something could be labeled if the company chose to label it. and how it could be labeled as not containing genetically engineered material if somebody else wanted to say, mine doesn't have it in there. This is now coming to a head because Vermont passed a law requiring labeling of genetically modified foods. That law goes into effect in July 1st, and they did so under the rubric that consumers ought to have a right to know this information, not because they thought there was a material fact that consumers needed to know. And Congress is right now, given everything else on their plate, trying to figure out if they're going to pass a law that would preempt what Vermont just did. So stay tuned to that. One other thing that I'll mention is that for those of you dealing with Zika, we also regulate the mosquito that everybody's been talking about, the genetically engineered mosquito. Hard to believe that we regulate the mosquito. And we regulate the mosquito for the same reason that we regulate the salmon, which is that the insertion of the genetic material is designed to affect the structure and function of the mosquito, in this case to kill it. And that's the definition of a new animal drug. And so it's regulated by our Center for Veterinary Medicine. The company submitted an application to do a pilot of this in the Florida Keys in 2012 to reduce mosquito populations. They didn't make any disease reduction claim like that this would control dengue or it would control Zika. We issued a draft environmental assessment, which is a requirement, in March 2016, saying we found that there'd be no significant environmental impact, and that right now is under review. What I can say to you is that this is very controversial in the community in which this pilot is supposed to be done. Here's something that I pulled off the internet just the other day. This is going to be put to a vote in the Florida Keys in August, where they will get to vote on whether or not they agree to have this mosquito released in the Florida Keys, and we're kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. The very last thing I'm going to mention very quickly is antimicrobial resistance. These are data that we're required to collect on the amount of antibiotics being sold for use in animals on an annual basis. And what you can see there is over a five-year time period, the volume of sales has gone up in the wrong direction by 22%, and even between 2013 and 2014, it went up by 4%, and so things are not going in the right direction. These are data from NARMS looking at the patterns of antimicrobial resistance that are collected in NARMS amongst humans and animals, and on the part of FDA from retail meats. And what are we in the process of doing about it? Well, in 2013, we issued a guidance for industry that voluntarily removes growth promotion indications from all medically important antimicrobials used in animals. Industry 100% complied, and the compliance date in which this is supposed to take effect is January 1st of 2017. In addition, we put something out called a veterinary feed directive, which requires all antimicrobials used in animals to be used under the oversight of a veterinarian. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in industry in reducing and being able to advertise that their foods are antibiotic-free. We're in the process of enhancing the NARMS data to be able to get better data to see what the impact of this is. We've added on antimicrobial sales by species, and we are also going to be working with USDA to be able to collect data down to the farm level once these things take effect to see what their impact is. So the last thing that I'll say is all of the work that I presented is done by literally hundreds and hundreds of people at FDA, and so this is their work. It's not mine. I've only been in the position for 3 weeks, so I can't claim credit for much of it. But the bottom line that I'll say, it's a really interesting place to work where you can do really good things for public health from a very different point of view than my years at CDC, but it's equally rewarding and beneficial. So I will stop by saying if you ask me anything I don't know, I'm not going to answer. So thanks, everybody. It's great to be here.